This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents In Death Ground, written by David Weber and Steve White, performed by Mark Vitor. In difficult ground, press on. In encircled ground, devise stratagems. In death ground, fight. Sun Tzu, The Art of War, circa 400 BC. Book 1. Before the Thunder. The cruiser floated against the unmoving starfield with every active system down. Only its passive sensors were powered, listening, watching, probing the endless dark. It hovered like a drifting shark, hidden in the vastness as in some bottomless bed of kelp, and no smallest, faintest emission betrayed its presence.
"So, Ursula, is the circus ready?"
Commodore Lloyd Braun grinned at his flagship's captain. Despite requests, HQ had decided Survey Flotilla 27 was too small for its CO to require a staff,
so Commander Elswick found herself acting as his chief of staff as well as his flag captain.
She hadn't known that was going to happen when her ship was first assigned to Braun, but she had the self-confidence that came with being very good at her job, and now she cocked an eyebrow back at him.
"It is if the ringmaster is, sir," she said, and he chuckled.
"In that case, what say we get this show on the road? Outward and onward for the glory of the Federation and all that."
"Of course, sir."
Elswick glanced at her comm officer.
"Inform Captain Cheltwin we're about to make transit, Alan."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"As for you, Stu," Elswick continued, turning to her astrogator,
"let's move out."
"Aye, aye, sir."
The astrogator nodded to his helmsman.
"Bring us on vector, Chief Malthus, but take it easy till I get a feel for the surge."
The helmsman acknowledged the order, and Commodore Braun sipped coffee with studied nonchalance, as the plot's icons blinked to reflect his command's shift to full readiness. The fact that Captain Alex Chelton, commanding Light Carrier Division 73 from the light cruiser Bremerton, was battle fleet, not survey command, had bothered Braun at first. The captain's seniority had made him Braun second in command, and while Braun knew too much about the sorts of trouble exploration ships had stumbled into over the centuries to share the cheerful contempt many survey officers exuded for the gunslingers the Admiralty insisted on assigning to even routine missions, he really would have preferred Ursula Elswick or Roddy Cherak of the Ute in Cheltwin's slot. Both of them were survey veterans, specialists like Braun himself, with whom he'd felt an immediate rapport. Yet any reservations about Cheltwin had faded quickly. Alex wasn't survey, but he was sharp, and despite Braun's seniority, he was also a far better tactician. Of course, a battle fleet officer ought to be a better warrior than someone who'd spent his entire career in survey, but Alex had gone to some lengths to pretend he didn't know he was. Braun wouldn't have minded if he hadn't bothered, but that didn't keep the Commodore from appreciating his tact. And truth to tell, Braun was delighted to have someone with Cheltwin's competence commanding the warships escorting his 6 exploration cruisers. Traditionally, survey crews found boredom a far greater threat than hostile aliens, but it was comforting to know help, and especially competent help, was available at need. The Commodore blinked back from his thoughts as TFNS Argive edged into the fringes of a featureless dot in space, visible only to her sensors, and her plotting officer studied his readouts.
"Grav Eddy's building," Lieutenant Channing reported, "right on the profile for a Type 8. Estimate transit in 25 seconds.
Braun sipped more coffee and nodded. Survey Command had known the warp point was a Type 8 ever since the old Arapaho first plotted it during the Indra system's initial survey 40 years back. But Survey considered itself a corps d'élite. Channing was simply doing his job as he always did, with utter competence, and the fact that he might be using that competence to hide a certain nervousness was beside the point, mostly. Braun chuckled at the thought. He'd literally lost count of the first transits he'd made, yet that didn't keep him from feeling a bit of, well, call it nervous anticipation. R&D had promised delivery of warp-capable robotic probes for years now, but Braun would believe in them when he saw them. Until he did, the only way to discover what lay beyond a warp point remained what it had always been, to send a ship through to see, which could sometimes be a bit rough on the ship in question. The vast majority of first transits turned out to be purest routine, but there was always a chance they wouldn't, and everyone had heard stories of ships that emerged from transit too close to a star, or perhaps a black hole, and were never heard of again. That was one reason some survey officers wanted to rewrite SOP to use pinnaces for first transits instead of starships. Unlike most small craft, pinnaces were big and tough enough to make transit on their own, yet they required only 6-man crews, and the logic of risking just a half a dozen lives instead of the 300 men and women who crewed a Hun-class cruiser like Argive was persuasive. Yet HQ had so far rejected the notion. Survey Command lost more ships to accidents in normal space than on exploration duties. Statistically speaking, a man had a better chance of being struck by lightning on dirtside Liberty than of being killed on a first transit. And that, coupled with the enormous difference in capability between a 40,000-ton cruiser like Argive and a pinnace, was more than enough to explain HQ's resistance to changing its operational doctrine. A pinnace had no shields, no weapons, and no ECM. Because a Hun-class CL did have shields, it could survive a transit which would dump a pinnace within fatal proximity to a star. It could also defend itself if it turned out unfriendly individuals awaited it, something which might have happened rarely, but, as Commander Cheltwin's presence reflected, could never be entirely ruled out. And while its emission signature was detectable over a far greater range than a pinnace's, it also mounted third-generation ECM. Unless someone was looking exactly the right way to spot it in the instant it made transit, it could disappear into cloak, which no pinnace could. And last but not least, its sensor suite had enormously more reach than any small craft could boast. All in all, Braun had come down on HQ's side. Things that could eat a light cruiser the size of many heavy cruisers were far rarer than things that could eat a pinnace.
"Transit, now," Channing reported, and Braun's stomach heaved, just as it always did, as the surge of warp transit wrenched at his inner ear. He saw other people try to hide matching grimaces of discomfort, and his mouth quirked in familiar amusement. He'd met a few people over the years who claimed transit didn't bother them at all, and he made it a firm policy never to lend such mendacious souls money. But that was only a passing thought, for his attention was on his display. For all his deliberate disinterest, this was the real reason he'd fought for survey duty straight out of the academy. Survey attracted those with incurable wanderlust, the sort who simply had to know what lay beyond the next hill and the first look at a new star system. The knowledge that his were among the very first human eyes ever to see it still filled the Commodore with a childlike wonder and delight. "Primary's an M-9," Channing reported. Yet not even that announcement could quench Braun's sense of accomplishment. A red dwarf meant the possibility of finding a useful habitable planet was virtually non-existent, but that didn't make the system useless. Many an unpopulated star system had proven an immensely valuable warp junction, and,
"Sir, our emergence point's a Type 14, Channing said suddenly, and Braun twitched upright in his command chair.
"Confirm," he said sharply, but it was only a reflex. Officers like Channing didn't make that sort of mistake, and his mind kicked into high gear as plotting double-checked the data.
"Confirmed, Commodore. Definitely a Type 14.
Prep and launch the drone, Captain Elswick. Then go to Condition Baker, standard spiral."
Braun made himself sit back once more, laying his forearms on the arms of his chair, and pushed the sharpness out of his voice. No need to get excited just because it was a closed warp point, he told himself firmly. They weren't all that uncommon.
"Aye, aye, sir. Communications, launch the drone. Tactical, take us into cloak at Condition Baker and confirm."
Braun frowned at his plot as Argive expelled a warp-capable courier drone to alert Cheltwin and the rest of the flotilla, then began to move once more, sweeping outward in a standard survey spiral, hidden by her ECM while passive sensors peered into the endless dark. A subtly different tension gripped her bridge crew, and Braun's frown deepened as he ran through his mission brief once more. There'd been little pressure to survey the Indra system's unexplored warp point for 40 years, for two reasons. First, there'd been no human population within 5 transits of it, until the first outposts went in Meriwether and Erebor, so Survey had seen no pressing need to explore further. That, as Braun well knew, reflected budgetary constraints as much as anything else. The corporate world-dominated federal government was much more inclined to fund Survey's operations to maintain nav beacons and update charts for heavily traveled areas than to waste money on speculative missions in underpopulated regions of the fringe. But the second reason no one had attached any urgency to exploring Indra's single, unsurveyed warp point was that nothing had ever come out of it. The non-appearance of anyone else's surveying starships had seemed to indicate there was no star-traveling species, and so no external threat to the Federation's security on its other side. But that comfortable assumption had just become inoperable. Closed warp points were far less common than open ones, or at least astrographers had traditionally assumed they were. It was hard to be positive, since the only way to locate a closed point was to come through it from an open one on the far end of the link, and the latest models suggested closed points might in fact occur much more frequently than previously assumed. Indeed, the more recent math predicted that the conditions which created such warp points in the first place would tend to put closed points at both ends of a link. If true, there could be hundreds of undetectable warp lines threaded all through explored space. But what mattered just now was that the discovery that Indra's open warp point connected to a closed one here automatically upgraded SF-27's mission status. If no one could even find the thing, the fact that no one had come through it meant nothing, so the possibility of meeting another advanced species increased exponentially. Star-traveling races were rare. So far, humanity had encountered barely 6 of them. But some of those encounters had been traumatic, and Survey Command's operational doctrine had been established as far back as the First Interstellar War. The first responsibility of any survey ship was to report the existence of such a race before attempting to make contact, and the second was to see to it that no potentially hostile species learned anything about the Federation's astrography until formal contact.
And the newcomer's bona fides had been established.
The best way to accomplish both those ends was to be sure no newly encountered race even knew the survey force was present until it had been observed at length, which was the reason the Hun class mounted cloaking ECM.
"We've completed the initial sweep, Commodore."
Braun looked up as Channing swiveled his own bridge chair to face him.
"No artificial emissions detected."
"Thank you."
Braun leaned back once more and crossed his legs, rubbing his chin as he glanced at Commander Elswick.
"It looks like we're in clean," he said, and she nodded.
"Yes, sir. The question is whether or not there's anyone out there to notice anything anyway."
"True, true."
Braun pursed his lips, then shrugged.
"You know the odds against that, but we'll play this strictly by the book. Continue your spiral, but hold your drive to no more than half power and maintain condition Baker."
"Of course, sir."
Elswick returned her attention to her own console, and Braun settled himself in his chair. It was going to be a longer watch than he'd anticipated.
"Well, that seems to be that, sir," Commander Elswick observed.
Braun nodded slowly, his eyes still on the rough hollow chart. The system they'd assigned the temporary name of Alpha One was thoroughly unprepossessing, with only 8 planets, the innermost a gas giant 7 light minutes from its dim primary. Argive had been in system for over 6 days now without detecting anything but lifeless worlds, and what might be a second warp point just over 3 light hours from the star. There'd certainly been none of the clutter star-traveling civilizations tended to leave lying about, like nav buoys or comm relays. On the other hand, any star system was an enormous haystack. Scores of starships could be hidden in this one, and as long as they radiated no betraying emissions, they'd all be effectively invisible. Argive by herself had far little to sensor range to sweep such a huge volume for covert targets, assuming there were, in fact, any to be found. And Braun was eager to get on with the system's survey, which was his proper task. The question was how he did so. SOP required him to bring his escorts through to cover the survey cruisers, but Cheltwin's gunslingers had no cloaking ECM. If Braun brought them up, the flotilla's presence would be obvious to any hidden watcher. The cloaked Huns might not be detectable, but the carriers and their screen would be, even under tight emissions control. He snorted mentally at his own thoughts. If Ursula's scanner crews hadn't spotted anything, odds were there was nothing to spot, despite the volume to be searched, for Argive had a far better chance of detecting anyone else than they had of detecting her. Even the best sensors had an omnidirectional range of little more than 72 light minutes against something as small as a starship's drive field, and given that their entry warp point had been a closed one, 5 light hours from the primary, no one could even have known where it was in order to keep a sensor watch on it. Not even the most eagle-eyed watcher could have detected their actual arrival, and they'd gone into cloak immediately, so for anyone to be out there and unseen, they'd have to be hiding just as hard as Argive was. And that was ridiculous. Why should anyone hide in his own stellar backyard, particularly when he thought the backyard in question held no unexplored warp points? It would take something more severe than mere paranoia to inspire that sort of behavior. "All right, Ursula," he said finally. "Call Alex forward. We'll hold the gunslingers on the warp point under tight MCON and turn the rest of the squadron loose in cloak." "Yes, sir." Argive's captain seemed to hesitate a moment, her eyes on Braun's face, and the Commodore quirked an eyebrow. "Something on your mind?"
"I was thinking about asking you that, sir. I've got the feeling you're not entirely comfortable about something."
"Not comfortable?" Braun frowned at the hollow, then shook his head. "I'm not uncomfortable. This isn't my first closed warp point, just the first one when I've been the fellow in command. I suppose I'm finally beginning to understand why the old fuddy-duddies I used to serve under seem to take so long to get off the pot. But," he shoved himself up with a grin, "that's why they pay me the big money, isn't it? Go ahead and get the drone off to Alex."
Chapter 1. The Fate of the Argive. The drifting cruiser had missed Argive's arrival, but it stirred at last as a cluster of energy sources appeared where they had no right to be. Passive sensors reoriented on the betraying signatures of unknown starships, and a trickle of power sent it sliding closer to them. Silent as the vacuum about it, a darker shadow in a lightless room. The newcomers were obviously practicing strict emissions control, but they were not cloaked, and the signatures of their standby drive fields betrayed them. The watching cruiser hovered, counting them, prying at their emissions to learn their secrets, and a comm laser deployed. It adjusted itself with finicky precision, aligning its emitter on another patch of space, one as empty to any sensor as that which held the cruiser itself, and a burst transmission flicked across the light hours. There was no acknowledgement, but the watching cruiser had expected none. It had discharged the first part of its own function by sounding the warning. Now it set about the second part of its duties, maintaining its stealthy watch upon the intruders and waiting.
"Everything in order at your end, Alex?" Commodore Braun asked, the face on his comm screen.
"Yes, sir. Kersaint's got the back door, and the rest of the flotilla's ready when you are."
"Good."
Braun nodded in satisfaction. Detaching the single destroyer to cover the Indra warp point was almost certainly unnecessary, but standing orders were firm. Kersaint was the insurance policy. If anything nasty transpired, the destroyer would be clear of it, able to fire out courier drones to alert the rest of the Federation, whatever happened to the rest of SF-27. Not that anything was likely to happen. They'd spent almost 4 months sweeping Alpha-1 without turning up a single sign of intelligent life. The survey had taken much longer than usual due to Condition Baker's requirement that the survey cruisers remain permanently cloaked, and Braun knew his personnel were even more eager than usual to check out the 2 outbound warp points they'd plotted. If neither of them led to closed points, the flotilla could revert to normal operations and put all this stealthy creeping about behind it.
"Very well, then, Alex. We'll check back with you shortly."
"We'll be here, sir,"
Cheltman agreed, and Braun waved a casual salute to the screen and glanced at Elswick.
"Once more into the breach, dear comrades."
"Yes, sir. You have the con, Stu."
"I have the con, aye," the astrogator confirmed,
and TFNS Argive crept forward into yet another warp point. A dozen ships waited, hidden in cloak, and spread to intercept any vessel bound in system from the warp point. But the picket cruiser's reports had revealed a problem. Many of the intruders were faster than any of the waiting defenders. The defenders couldn't overtake them in a stern chase, nor could the picket send warning when the intruders made transit. The alien ships were clustered about the warp point, certain to spot any courier drone which might be sent through, and that would warn them to flee. The defenders thus found themselves forced to guess about the enemy's current maneuvers and plans. But they knew he was surveying. That meant he was bound to come through eventually, and so the ambush had been set. If the intruders were obliging enough to send their entire force through the warp point and into point-blank range, there would be no need to pursue. And if they declined to do so, perhaps they could be induced to change their plans. The transit was a rough one, but Braun shook off his disorientation and nausea as Argive's temporarily addled electronics sorted themselves out, and Channing checked his readouts.
System primary is a G-0, the lieutenant reported.
Braun's display restabilized, and he grimaced. A starship's initial heading upon emergence from an unsurveyed warp point was impossible to predict. Grav surge could, and did, spit a ship out on any vector, and until a point had been thoroughly plotted, no astrogator could adjust for it. Of course, that seldom mattered much. Since he didn't know anything about what lay at an unplotted warp point's terminus, one vector was as good as another. In this instance, however, the system's central star lay almost directly astern. The warp point was well above the ecliptic, giving Argive's sensors an excellent look down at it, but her course took her steadily away from the primary, and Braun had just opened his mouth to order Commander Elswick to bring her ship about when Channing's senior petty officer spoke up. "Emergence point is a Type 6," she announced, and Braun exhaled in satisfaction. A Type 6 was open, so perhaps they could forget all this cloaked sneaking about, and... "I'm getting artificial emissions," Channing snapped suddenly, and Braun whipped his command chair around to face plotting. "What sort?" he demanded.
"Clear across the spectrum, sir."
Channing's voice was flatter, but it was the clipped, hard flatness of professionalism, not calmness.
"Looks like navigation beacons further in system, but I'm also getting radar and radio."
"I'm showing unknown drive fields in system,"
the TAC officer said, in the same clipped tones.
"How many?"
"Lots of them, sir," Tactical said grimly. "Over 100 at least."
"Jesus," someone whispered, and Braun felt his own face tighten.
"Condition able, Captain Elswick."
"Condition able, aye."
Elswick nodded sharply to the TAC officer, and the shrill, atonal wail of Argive's general quarters alarm whooped. Despite her size, the specialized equipment of her calling put a severe squeeze on the survey cruiser's armament. She had barely half the broadside of Battlefleet's Bulwark-class heavy cruisers, but her weapons crew closed up with gratifying speed as the alarm screamed at them.
"Update the drone. Append a full sensor readout and launch," Braun ordered through the disciplined chaos.
Argive's speed was so low, the range to the warp point had opened to little more than 1,000 kilometers, and the courier drone's drive was no more than a brief flicker across the plot as it streaked away at 60,000 kps. The Commodore watched it go, then turned his eyes back to the fresh icons appearing on the large-scale master plot as plotting and tactical worked with frantic haste to update it.
"Commodore, I've got something strange here."
Channing sounded as if he could hardly believe his own sensors, and Braun raised his eyebrows at him.
"Sir, this system has at least 3 planets in the liquid water zone. I've only got good reads on 2 of them from here, but..."
"Sir, I'm picking up massive energy signatures from both of them."
"How massive?"
"I can't be certain from this far out," Channing began, but the Commodore chopped a hand at him.
"Give me your best guess, Lieutenant."
"Sir, I've never seen anything like it. Both of them look bigger than old Terra herself."
Braun stared at him in disbelief. Humanity's homeworld was by any measure the most heavily industrialized planet in known space. Not even New Valka came close.
"I'm sorry, sir," Channing said defensively, "but don't sweat it."
Braun shook himself and managed a crooked smile.
"Just be sure the standby drone gets a continuous update of your findings."
"Aye, aye, sir." Channing sounded relieved by the mundaneness of the order, and Braun turned to Commander Elswick.
"Let's not get in too deep, Ursula. Come to 050. We'll sweep the perimeter for a while and see if we can get a better feel before we move further in-system."
"They've found what?"
Captain Alex Cheltwin looked at his communications officer in disbelief, then yanked his eyes down to the display at his elbow as the drone completed its download and a new star system appeared. Detail was sadly lacking from the preliminary data, but bright scarlet icons glowed balefully in its depths, and his nostrils flared as he studied them. Commodore Braun held the ultimate responsibility, but he was on the far side of the warp point. It was up to Cheltwin to decide what to do with the rest of the flotilla, not just the escort, and his brain shifted into high gear. Even Argive's preliminary info suggested the presence of a massive, highly advanced culture, and unlike the link to Indra, both of this line's warp points were open. So why hadn't they seen any sign of these people on this side? There might not be any habitable worlds, but why weren't Alpha One's warp points even buoyed? It was possible its only other open point led to an equally useless cul-de-sac, which might explain the absence of navigation buoys, but Cheltwin couldn't afford to assume that. Yet if that wasn't the case, then the absence of any space-borne artifacts could only represent a deliberate decision on someone's part. Either that, or...
"Calm, raise Ute. Advise Commander Chirac of Argive's report and instruct him to stand by to fall back on the Indra warp point with the rest of the Huns. Then get off a transmission to Kersaint. Download the full report and instruct Commander Hausmann to relay to Sarasota."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"Allison, bring us to Condition Able and have Commander Mangudilaga arm San Jacinto's squadrons for a shipping strike. We'll use Shahs for fighter defense if we need them."
"Yes, sir."
His exec turned to her terminal and began inputting orders, and Cheltwin stared back down into his plot and gnawed his lower lip. Something didn't add up here, and a worm of acid burned in the pit of his belly. The fact that the intruder had emerged from an unexplored warp point headed out-system wasn't surprising, but it hadn't changed course to head in-system. Like all its other electronic systems, its cloaking ECM had fluctuated as it made transit, and the watching sensors had spotted it easily. With that head start, and helped by its low speed, they tracked it with relative ease despite its cloak, but its heading took it directly away from the ships deployed to catch it. Worse, it had not summoned its fellows forward, and its sensors must be amassing more system data with every passing second. Minutes trickled past while the intruder continued to move away from them, and then, at last, six super dreadnoughts and six battlecruisers turned to pursue.
"Sir, I think you'd better take a look at this."
"At what?"
Commander Salvatore Hausmann looked up with a frown. Captain Cheltwin's electrifying transmission had come in 3 hours ago, and Hausmann had been deep in discussion of its implications with his executive officer.
"This, sir."
The TAC officer tapped his display, and Hausmann stepped closer to look over his shoulder. A vague blur of light flickered in the plot, and Hausmann's frown deepened.
"What is that, Ismail?"
"Skipper, that's either a sensor ghost or an active cloaking system at about 36 light seconds."
"A cloaking system?"
Hausmann stiffened, eyes suddenly wide, and the TAC officer nodded grimly.
"How long has it been there?"
"Just turned up, Skip. If it is somebody in cloak, he's closing in very slowly. I make it about 1500 KPS.
Hausmann grunted as if he'd been punched in the belly, and his mind raced.
It couldn't be a cloaked starship, could it?
The very idea was insane, but Ismail Cantor wasn't the sort to make that kind of mistake. The commander turned away and pounded his fists gently together. Kersaint was 4.5 light hours from the rest of the flotilla, and that meant Hausmann was on his own. If that was a cloaked ship, it could only mean the people whose existence Commodore Braun had just discovered already knew the flotilla was here. But if they knew, and hadn't even attempted to make contact, and now they were trying to sneak in close...
"Stay on it, Ismail," he said. "Don't go active, but get missile defense online. I want an intercept solution cycling 10 minutes ago."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"Calm,"
Hausmann wheeled to his communications officer.
"Record for transmission to Captain Cheltwin."
Recording, the comm officer replied instantly, and Hausman faced the pickup.
Sir, Tactical has just detected what may be, I repeat, may be, a cloaked starship closing my position from,
he glanced at his repeater display,
092103 at approximately 1500 KPS. I will initiate no hostile action, but if attacked, I will defend myself. Please advise me soonest of your intentions and desires. Got that?
Yes, sir.
Send it priority one,
Hausman said grimly, and settled back in his chair as the light-speed burst transmission sped across the vacuum. His warning would take over 4 hours to reach its destination. Any reply would take another 4 hours to reach him, and he thought grimly, if that signature was a cloaked ship, that would be at least 6 hours too long. The picketing cruiser eased closer to the unsuspecting enemy ship that sat motionless on the warp point. Its active sensors and targeting systems remained on standby, but its missiles were ready, and its mission was simple. Commander Elswick and Braun stood side by side, staring into the master plot, and Argive's captain shook her head as still more icons appeared. The range was far too great for detailed resolution, but Braun had decided to chance deploying a pair of recon drones. It was a risk, since the drones couldn't cloak, but their drive fields were weak. The chance that someone might notice them was remote, yet they extended Argive's sensor reach over a light hour further in-system, and what they reported was incredible. The system swarmed with activity. Drive fields, tentatively ID'd as freighters, moved back and forth between its huge asteroid belt and the inner planets, and the RDs had long-range readings on the mammoth orbital constructs those freighters apparently served. Braun had once spent 20 months in the Sol system on a routine cartography update, and the spaceborne activity of this system dwarfed anything he'd seen there. He pinched the bridge of his nose, then looked up as Lieutenant Channing appeared beside him.
"Commodore, you're not going to believe this," the lieutenant said quietly. "But I've just gotten a look at the third orbital shell. It's not another habitable planet. It's two of them."
"Twin planets?"
"Yes, sir. They're both around 1.2 standard masses, orbiting about a common center." The lieutenant shook his head.
"That makes four of them, sir. Four in one system."
"Lord."
Braun shook his own head, trying to imagine the sort of industrial base a star system with four massively populated planets could support. Survey Command had come across quite a few twin planets in its explorations, but he couldn't remember a single system with this much habitable real estate, which raised an interesting question.
"This is a big system, Ursula," he mused. "If you were these people, wouldn't you feel a certain need to make sure nothing nasty happened to it?"
"Sir," Elswick frowned, and he plucked at his lower lip.
"They've got four inhabited planets. From all the energy they're radiating, each of them must have a population in the billions. Assuming our own tech base is any sort of meter stick, shouldn't a nodal system like this have better security than we've seen?"
"But we don't know what sort of security they have, sir," Elswick pointed out. "We're assuming all these drives," her finger stabbed at the plot, "are freighters, because there's no reason they should be anything else. But we're still way too far out to get any kind of look at what they may have in the inner system. I'll bet their inhabited worlds have orbital fortifications, and we didn't see any sign of them on the far side of the warp point. To me, that suggests they figure Alpha One's a cul-de-sac." She shrugged. "If the system's useless, there's no point maintaining fortifications or a standing picket to watch its warp point. For all we know, the points that do lead somewhere are crawling with OWPs and patrols."
"Maybe." Braun peered into the plot for another long moment, then turned back to his command chair.
"Maybe," he repeated, shaking his head as he sat. "But I don't buy it. If Sol had more than one warp point, don't you think Battlefleet would at least picket the second one, even if we knew it didn't lead anywhere? Think about it. We know closed warp points exist. Don't you think these people must know it as well?"
"Well, yes, sir. And if they know about them, why aren't they even remotely concerned? We've been sneaking around in their space for over 10 hours now. If we were so inclined, we could sneak right back out and whistle up the entire home fleet."
"What are you getting at, sir?"
Elswick asked slowly.
I don't know, Braun admitted. It just doesn't make sense to me.
He frowned for another moment, then shrugged.
Well, whoever these people are, it's time to leave. I don't want to sound paranoid, but I feel a lot more confident making a first contact with someone this big if at least half of Home Fleet was handy.
Paranoia can be a survival tool, sir, Elswick observed, and Braun snorted in agreement.
Turn us around, Captain. Let's get out of here.
The pursuing starships had drawn their dispersed units into closer company, but they'd been unable to overhaul the intruder. It was just as fast as they, and its course had persisted in carrying it away from them. But now it had come about, and they slowed. The intruder's new course would carry it directly back to its entry warp point, and coupled with its failure to summon its consorts to join it, that was an ominous sign. It must have obtained sufficient data for its purposes. Now it was falling back to join the others, and the enemy's unwillingness to thrust all of its ships into an ambush was unacceptable. The Guardian starships halted, then the super dreadnoughts came to a new heading, bound for the invaders' entry warp point at their maximum speed, while the battle cruisers waited. Lloyd Braun made himself sit quietly, radiating calm. It was hard. He was even more aware of the gnawing tension than Argive's crew was, for the ultimate responsibility was his. That was true of any commanding officer, but at a moment like this... The sudden shocking howl of an alarm jerked his eyes down to his display, and his face went white. Six drive fields had blinked into existence, appearing out of nowhere, directly ahead of Argive, and he swallowed an incredulous, frightened oath as their field strength registered.
Six unknowns, Channing said, in the flat, sing-song half-chant of someone relying on training to keep him functioning in the face of shock.
Frequency unknown. I show battlecruiser range masses, bearing 003010, range 16 light seconds, and closing.
Wideband emissions from unknowns, Tactical weighed in.
Radar and laser. Battle comp calls them targeting systems.
Come, initiate first contact protocols,
Braun snapped. But deep inside, he knew the effort was futile. Those ships had appeared too suddenly, and they were too close. Barely 5 light seconds outside standard missile range, and already well inside the capital missile envelope. Watching Argive, even stalking her from cloak, might have been no more than a sensible precaution. But uncloaking this abruptly, and lighting her up with tracking systems without even attempting to communicate first... was something else, and he looked at Elswick.
Bring in the Omega circuit for continuous drone update, but do not launch.
Aye, aye, sir.
Elswick jerked her chin at her comm officer, passing on the order, but her attention was focused on tactical. The rest of the flotilla was Braun's responsibility. The survival of her ship and crew was hers.
Any response to our hail? The Commodore asked tautly.
None, sir.
The comm officer's voice was flat, and Braun's jaw tightened as fresh light codes flashed beside the red ring dots of the unknown battlecruisers. There were no Ehrlicher emissions to indicate readied force beams or primaries, but the energy signatures of activated missile launchers were unmistakable. Instinct urged him to launch the drone now, for his overriding responsibility was to get his data out, but the drone launch would almost certainly be construed as a hostile act. Unlikely as it might be that the newcomer's intentions were pacific, there was no way he could know they were until and unless those battlecruisers fired.
"Sir, there's something odd about their drive fields," Tactical said,
and Braun and Elswick both looked at him as he tapped keys at his console.
"They're too unfamiliar to be certain, but I think those may be commercial drives," he said finally,
and Braun frowned.
"Commercial drives? Why would anyone put civilian drives into battle cruisers?
Commercial engines were more durable, more energy efficient, and required smaller engineering staffs than the unit's most warships mounted. Unlike military drives, they could also be run at full power indefinitely, but they paid for that by being twice as massive, and their maximum speed was barely 2/3 as great. Freighter designers loved their durability and cost efficiency, but only a few special-purpose warships, like Argive herself, who spent most of her time moving slowly along surveying, could afford the mass penalty or accept a lower combat speed. But whether or not commercial-engined BCs made sense, it might give Argive a minute chance of survival, for it meant the alien vessels were no faster than she was. "Still no response, Com?"
"None, sir," the communications officer replied, and Braun nodded grimly.
"Go to evasive action, Captain."
"Aye, aye, sir. Helm, come about 180 degrees.
Braun stared into his display, watching the battlecruisers as Argive swung directly away from them. Her efforts to avoid them might be taken as the final proof her intentions were hostile, but he dared not let that much firepower into any closer range. Argive carried only standard missiles, but those ships were big enough to mount capital launchers. If they did, they were already well within their own range. And if they were inclined to—
"Missile separation!" Tactical snapped suddenly. "I have multiple missile separations. Time to impact, 22 seconds.
"Stand by point defense," Ursula Elswick said harshly. The battlecruisers flushed their external ordnance racks, and 48 capital missiles screamed through space at 0.6C, closing on the single alien ship like vengeful sharks.
Counter-missiles raced to meet the incoming fire, but Argive was an exploration ship. Her defenses were far too light to survive that weight of fire, and Commodore Braun's jaw clenched. "Launch the drone!"
The cruiser's ready courier drone blasted from its box launcher, streaking towards the warp point, and it seemed to take the enemy by surprise. None of them even tried to engage it as it flashed past them on a diametrically opposed vector, and Braun tried to take some bleak satisfaction from that, but he couldn't look away from the incoming fire.
Fireball intercepts began to spall the space between his flagship and her enemies. Each savage flash was one less missile for the close-in defenses to handle, but too few were dying. 30 missiles broke through the counter-missile zone, and laser clusters swiveled and spat like coherent light cobras. More missiles died, but the rest kept coming. And then Argive lurched like a windsick galleon as the first warhead exploded against her shields. The explosions went on and on, battering the ship like the fists of a furious giant, and Braun clung to the arms of his command chair with fingers of iron until the terrible concussions ended.
7 hits, Skipper, Tactical reported. All standard nukes.
Damage? Elswick snapped back.
We've lost 90% of our shields, and we've got some shock damage, but that's it.
The TAC officer sounded as if he couldn't believe his own report, and Braun didn't blame him. That many battlecruisers should have torn Argive to bits, not that he intended to complain. He sat tense and still, waiting for the next salvo. There wasn't one, and he felt his muscles slowly unlock as he tried to figure out why. He punched a query into his plot with steady fingers that felt as if they were shaking like castanets, and his eyes narrowed. That salvo density was too low, unless—
Those were all from their external racks.
He hadn't realized he'd spoken aloud, but Elswick's head snapped around to face him, and he shrugged.
If they'd fired from their internal launchers as well, there'd have been at least 20 or 30 more birds. So maybe they don't have any internal capital launchers.
Maybe, she agreed. I'm certainly not going to complain if they don't anyway.
Me either, Braun replied, but something nagged at the back of his brain.
He shoved himself back in his chair, mind racing while engineering labored with trained haste to put the ship's shields back online, and his frown deepened. He tapped more commands into his display and watched the entire encounter replay in accelerated time, starting from the moment the battlecruisers uncloaked, and suddenly he stiffened.
Dear God, had they—
Captain Elswick!
Yes, sir?
I think they've suckered us. They wanted us to survive their first salvo.
I beg your pardon?
Elswick's eyes widened at his preposterous statement, and he shook his head sharply.
They should have scored more than 7 hits with that many birds. And why did they uncloak when they did? With luck, they could have closed the range another 4 light seconds before we picked them up. We would have been almost into standard missile range if they'd waited. They couldn't have counted on that, but why concede that big an advantage?
But, sir, why would—
Because they did have pickets in Alpha One, Braun said flatly. They've known we were there the whole time.
Dead silence filled the bridge. Every officer's eyes clung to the crimson-on-crimson light dots pursuing their ship,
and the sick, hollow voids in their bellies mirrored Braun's.
"Commercial drives," Elswick said, and the soft words were a bitter, venomous curse.
"Exactly." Braun's fist clenched on the arm of his command chair, but he made himself speak levelly.
"This wasn't an accident, Ursula, not a failed communications attempt. They were stalking us from the get-go. But if all their ships have commercial drives, and they did have pickets watching us, they must have realized the carriers and their escorts can outrun them. That's why they let us see them early, and why their targeting was so poor when they finally fired."
His eyes met those of Argai's captain, cold and bleak as death.
"We're bait, Ursula."
6 super dreadnoughts bored through space. A courier drone flashed almost directly through their formation, easily within engagement range, and they let it pass without a shot.
"Courier drone coming through, sir."
Alex Cheltwin looked up from the memo board in his lap, then rose and crossed to the comm officer's station to look over her shoulder as she queried the drone's memory. She tapped keys for a few moments, then jerked upright in her chair.
"Argive is under attack, sir,"
she exclaimed, and an icy fist squeezed Cheltwin's heart.
"Download the TAC data to plotting," he barked,
and spun towards Bremerton's master plot. The data flashed, and he flinched as he saw the battlecruisers appear from Cloak. He stood tautly, watching the plot, and someone gasped behind him as the angry light dots of capital missiles suddenly speckled the display. The drone had launched before impact, and he had no way to know how much damage that salvo had inflicted, but it looked bad. Lightning thoughts flickered through his brain as the ambush played itself out before him, and his lips drew back in a snarl. The bastards had ambushed Argive, but they must not have counted on the rest of the flotilla's presence. 6 BCs could tear any survey cruiser apart, but 5 more cruisers, especially with 2 light carriers in support, could more than return the favor.
"Communications, transmit the drone download to Kersaint. Instruct Commander Hausman to make immediate transit to Indra and relay the data to Sarasota."
"Aye, aye, sir,"
the comm officer responded, and he wheeled to his exec.
"We're going through, Allison. Callahan will lead, then the carriers. The rest of the Huns will bring up the rear."
"Yes, sir."
The exec bent over her console, punching in orders, and Cheltwin made himself return to his chair while Survey Flotilla 27 erupted into furious action. The picket cruisers noted the courier drone's arrival, and unlike Alexander Cheltwin, they'd known it would be coming. Even before Bremerton's comm officer queried its memory, a comm laser had already sent another message burst streaking across the system. TFNS Callahan raced through the warp point. Commander Chirac of the Ute had already worked up the sensor data from Argive's initial drone, and his rough calculations of the warp point's stresses made Callahan's transit far less violent than Argive's had been. It was still more than rough enough, but none of the destroyer's crew had time to waste on nausea. Their sensors were already sweeping the space about the warp point for any sign of the enemy. There was none, and Callahan's skipper fired his own drone back to announce the all-clear. The oncoming super-dreadnoughts picked up the first alien ship's drive signature. The enemy had reacted more swiftly than expected, and the capital ships were still beyond effective engagement range. But they had no desire to engage until all the enemy vessels were into the system anyway, and they altered course slightly, curling still further away from the system primary on a vector which would take them to the warp point well after the last enemy ship made transit. With the aliens' only avenue of retreat sealed, they would have no choice but to come to the super-dreadnoughts on the defenders' terms, and speed would avail them nothing then. Bremerton made transit, with San Jacinto and Shaw on her heels, and Cheltwin breathed a sigh of relief as the Hun-class cruisers followed them through. He'd been half afraid he was heading into an ambush, but the enemy had screwed up. They must have assumed Argive was operating solo, or they never would have let the rest of the flotilla into the system unopposed.
"Instruct Commander Chirac to launch recon drones," he said. "I want a light hour shell up and maintained. Then tell Commander Mangu Dilaga to hold his launch for my command."
"Aye, aye, sir."
He shoved himself firmly back in his comfortable chair. There was no point advertising his full capabilities any sooner than he had to. It was remotely possible the opposition didn't have fighters. After all, the Thebans hadn't had any 60-odd years ago. Even if it did, his own would prove far more effective if the bad guys didn't know he had them until they...
Sir, we're picking up a loop transmission from Argive. On my display,
Cheltwin snapped, and he looked down as Commodore Braun's grim face appeared on the screen beside his knee. The time display in the corner of the screen was a half hour old, and the captain shivered at the thought that the man behind that face might well already be dead. But then that thought vanished as Braun spoke.
Alex, if you receive this, turn around and get out of here, the Commodore said harshly. We've been mousetrapped. These people have commercial, repeat, commercial drives, and they're using Argive as bait. They were waiting for us, and they're probably waiting for you. If you're not already engaged, you will be shortly, so get the hell out. That's a direct order.
Braun paused for a moment, then forced a bleak smile.
Good luck, Alex. Get my people home.
The screen blanked, then lit once more, replaying the same message, and Alex Cheltwin's blood turned to ice. He stared at the display, willing the transmission to change, to say something else, but it simply repeated, and he closed his eyes tight.
Braun might be wrong, and if he was, and if he was still alive, Cheltwin's ships were Argive's only hope.
But he might not be wrong, and as the captain's brain ran back over the data from the drone download, he felt sickly certain the Commodore wasn't. And if he wasn't, there were only two possible reasons his own command wasn't already under attack. Either the enemy hadn't gotten to the warp point yet, or else he was waiting for Cheltwin to move still further in-system before he sprang the trap. Every instinct cried out to ignore Braun's order, to go to his Commodore's rescue. But the cold, pitiless light of his intellect said something else, and he drew a deep breath.
"Bring us about, Allison," he said, and his iron-hard voice was a stranger's.
The cruiser, which had crept stealthily closer to TFNS Kersaint for so many hours, received the transmission from its sister. The enemy had advanced into the trap. Now it was time to destroy the only vessel which might get word of the ambush out.
"Skipper, I'm picking up a transmission of some sort."
"What do you mean, of some sort?" Salvatore Hausmann's nerves had wound tighter and tighter as he watched the light blur on his plot. It hovered on the very edge of the standard missile envelope now, and the agonizing weight turned his voice harsh.
"Is it from Captain Cheltwin?"
"No, sir, I can't." Kersaint's comm officer shook her head. "It doesn't seem to be saying anything, Skipper. It's just some sort of electronic noise."
"Noise?" Hausmann repeated sharply.
"Yes, sir, it's almost like it's just a carrier. If it's got any content, my computers can't recognize it."
"Source?"
"I can't say for certain, but the bearing's about right to be from Captain Cheltwin." "Skipper, that bogey's moving again."
Lieutenant Cantor's crisp voice pulled Hausmann's attention away from the comm officer, and he darted another look at his display. The light blur was moving, and whoever was in command over there had to know he was at the edge of certain detection, cloaked or not. So why? The transmission. It had to be the transmission, and if the bogey was still coming in, rather than revealing its presence and attempting to communicate, the picket cruiser slid still closer, and then, suddenly, the alien starship, which had seemed so oblivious to its presence, reacted. Targeting systems lashed out, locked on, and before the picket could respond, the alien opened fire.
"There he is, Skip!"
Ismail Cantor snapped as his first salvo exploded. The range was long, but his passive sensors had been given over 5 hours to plot the bogey's movements. His targeting solution took full advantage of that data, and his external racks and internal launchers sent a dozen missiles streaking straight for it. 9 of his birds got through, and cloaking ECM was useless against active sensors at such short range. Light codes danced and flickered in the fire control display, and then the bogey glowed with the red-circled white dot of a hostile cruiser.
"She's a CL,"
Cantor reported as his second salvo went out, and Hausmann bared his teeth. A light cruiser was 30% larger than his destroyer, but cramming cloaking ECM into something that small ate deep into weapons volume.
unless the bastard had some sort of weapons technology the Federation had never heard of, he and Kersaint were evenly matched. Answering fire spat back, and Houseman's vicious smile grew broader as its weight confirmed his guess. "Launch the drone," he barked, and his comm officer sent a courier drone streaking through the warp point for the Sarasota fleet base. Whatever happened here, the Federation would know something had happened, and the Terran Federation Navy would do something about it. The corner of one eye watched the drone disappear, but his attention was on the enemy's light dot. "Come to 090, 003. Let's close the range on this bastard." The shocked picket cruiser writhed under the attack. The fire's accuracy proved its target had seen it coming, known it was there, and the sheer number of missiles was a dismaying surprise. The first stunning salvo ripped away its shields, breached its hull in dozens of places, and irradiated its external missiles into useless junk. The wounded ship belched wreckage and air as the alien vessel sprang into motion, speeding straight for it, but it made no attempt to flee. Instead, it accelerated to meet its foe. Two missile-armed starships charged straight towards one another, their launchers in continuous rapid fire. Kersaint was handicapped by the TFN practice of carrying no antimatter warheads in peacetime, lest a fluctuating containment field blow a ship apart. The enemy cruiser was under no such constraint, but at least it seemed to mount only first-generation AMs, not the vastly more destructive second-generation weapons. The range flashed downward, and both ships staggered as hits got through, but Kersaint's initial salvo had given her a crushing advantage, and she exploited it savagely. A dozen more of her missiles scored direct hits, lacerating her enemy, in return for only 3 hits of her own. But the enemy cruiser didn't even try to break off. It came straight for her, and both ships went to sprint mode fire as the range fell to 5 light seconds. The missiles shrieked in at such high velocities, point defense could no longer stop them, and Salvatore Houseman snarled as his ship staggered again and again. But he was winning. He could take the bastard, and then his eyes flared suddenly wide as the enemy cruiser altered course once more. It was only a small alteration, but— "Harder starboard!" he shouted. "Harder!" A savage fireball glared in the soundless depths of space as 2 starships met head-on at a closing velocity of 0.17C. The super dreadnoughts were still at extreme missile range when the aliens suddenly stopped advancing. They paused for just an instant, then reversed course, darting back the way they'd come, and the range was too great to stop them. But it wasn't great enough to let them escape totally unscathed. The super dreadnoughts twitched as they expelled a lethal cloud of external ordnance. A hurricane of fire sizzled toward the enemy, and even as they fired, one of the super dreadnoughts activated a comm laser. If there were no mice to be trapped, there was no longer any need to preserve the cheese, and a message flashed out to other cloaked ships. A fresh alarm sounded, and Commodore Lloyd Braun looked down into his plot. More icons spangled it, dozens of them strewn across Argive's bow in lethal clusters of crimson. He watched identification codes blink beside them, and his mouth tightened, not with surprise, not even with fear. He'd known this was coming, and all he felt was a strange, singing emptiness as the proof appeared. "I make it 10 super dreadnoughts and at least 20 battlecruisers, sir," Commander Elswick said softly, and he nodded. "Do you think Captain Shelton got out, sir?" she asked quietly. "I don't know, Ursula. I hope so. And he's good. Maybe he did." The Commodore looked down into his plot, and his eyes flicked to the 6 battlecruisers still clinging to his heels. He gazed at them for a long, silent moment, then drew a deep breath. "Somehow I don't feel much like surrendering," he said almost calmly. He looked up and caught Elswick's eye, and the commander nodded. "All right, then. We can't do much against those big bastards in front, but those fellows behind us have been chasing us long enough. Perhaps it's time we let them catch us." Ursula Elswick simply nodded, then raised her voice. "Alan, launch the Omega drones, then purge the computers." "Aye, aye, sir," the comm officer said quietly, and Elswick looked at her astrogator. "Bring us about, Stu," she said. "We're going down their throats."
Chapter 2. Stormwind Rising. Alex Cheltwin sat stiff and still as his display's lurid damage